And there goes Mac the Knife. Shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them a pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mac Heat, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows stop to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's Mac Heat, dear? So there's not a trace of red. On the sidewalk, Sunday morning, even, lies a body oozing life. Someone sneaking around the corner. Someone
Mac the Knife. All right, Mac the Knife. Long knives are being pulled out in the state of Michigan this day. That's Louis Armstrong with Mac the Knife. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, December 11th, and on this day, a big fight just went down, still is continuing in the state of Michigan. We'll be talking today about that. We'll talk about rogue banks. There's been a major development in that community that we need to talk about. And, of course, you. So let's go to Michigan. Just about half an hour ago, the Michigan State Legislature approved, with the governor's signature, a 58-51 vote. They passed a two-part package, and the first of a two-part package, I should say, having to do with, in some cases, the unions are seeing it as bashing the union and basically taking away workers' rights. But the Republicans are saying this is what they're doing to reflect workers' choices. And the issue has to do with barring the unionization, limiting, severely limiting unionization of the workplace, limiting it so that workers do not have to join the collective bargaining unit that might be in place and where they go to work. The counterargument is that workers should not have to be forced to join a collective bargaining unit, and they should not have to be forced to pay union dues because it's their choice to join a union or not. Of course, Michigan being a strong union town and the union movement across the country as a whole has seen this trend. Why? Because Michigan now becomes the 24th state to join in this right to work campaign that has been sweeping the nation. The argument on the other side is this. If one respects that individuals have rights, and they are free to exercise those rights, why must it be compulsory, and why would the state endorse it, that unions which would organize the workplace, would automatically get union dues. I mean, that's the way it works. When you are a member of a collective bargaining unit, your deductions are taken automatically from your paycheck, and they go to cover your dues as a union member. And your dues, of course, entitle you to many things, including representation, if you should be disciplined or should be unfairly treated. It allows the collective bargaining unit to negotiate pay. The collective bargaining unit also negotiates around working conditions and benefits, including things like vacation and medical benefits, health benefits, vacation, and so forth. It also allows the collective bargaining unit to represent the unit, or that's the people belonging to the unit, in terms of, in some cases, participating in the way the company or office is run. Sometimes, depending on the unit, they even sit down with the management, and they work out things that have to do with the future of the company and changes in work rules and so forth. So they create a disciplined environment, and a collective bargaining unit basically works out an arrangement with management in which both sides adhere to the terms of work and the conditions of work. Increasingly, however, especially since the movement began when jobs were exported overseas by the hundreds of thousands, as companies fled the United States, they felt that unions were too powerful, and unions were, in fact, inhibiting growth and, of course, cutting profits, because the more that unions extracted in terms of their collective bargaining process, the less the profits. And so many companies took off and they left the United States. And it started first where companies migrated to other friendly, quote-unquote, states, where the state laws were far more friendly to corporate interests than they were to workers. But then even the migration, the in-migration, that's moving from state to state or locality even, some places have stricter controls depending on localities even within a state. So companies started hunting around for the most favorable conditions to operate. And the largest condition that they had was the cost of employees. And then came the out-migration of jobs. In order to attract business back, to bring back the businesses, to bring back the jobs, the corporate community decided that what they needed was a friendly environment in the various state legislatures. Friendly environment meaning that they wanted the ability to set the terms and conditions of work. They hired very powerful lobbyists, very powerful lobbying firms that influenced the state legislatures. And in fact, that wasn't hard to do because the various states wanted to get back the businesses that they had lost and get new businesses that they were after. So they complied. And so the workers, it trickled down to the workers. Workers said, well, look, it's all about work. The unemployment rate was ridiculous. Whatever it is we've got to do to get our jobs, we'll do. And a heavy effort was made to sell the idea that it wasn't so much about the unions. It was that the unions were impeding progress in attracting new jobs. Well, for some employees, this made sense. I mean, after all, they should be able to decide what they will and will not accept. So they said, okay, sign me up. I'm okay with it. The flip side of the coin is that the unions themselves, I think, fell down on the job, because after a while, unions became very, very comfortable, and they stopped doing the essential part of what unions should do, which is organizing. The unions got fat and happy. Because of automatic dues checkoff privileges, that is, the automatic deduction of union dues, they knew they had a predictable source of revenue to do whatever it is they had to do. And they got very comfortable with that. And although the signs were there that things were going to get pretty dicey, I think many, many unions reacted and reacted too late. Also, I think unions looked more toward the national picture and forgot about local organizing. The collective bargaining unit is where you organize. You have to organize everything. I'm speaking now as a former shop steward myself and as a person who actually brought in a union, the industry standard union, into the workplace and facilitated a shift from one union to the other. And they said it was an experience they never had, and it was an extraordinarily progressive move. I wanted the people working to have the best that they were entitled to, and for which, of course, they had been denied for a long, long time. I wanted them to adhere to industry standards. And so that was worked out. But I also know that many unions had shortcomings. The representation of some collective bargaining units was very low. You had a lot of widespread corruption within the unions themselves, that they failed to, as a group, they really ran off the plantation there for a while. And I don't think that the unions were prepared or really prescient in this way to get really entrenched in this kind of trench warfare. This is what it is. So the critical mass has arrived now, and the unions have been very active because the Republicans have had a chance to reorganize, have been very powerful in those legislatures, for example, as in Michigan. The Republicans own both houses of the legislature. So although this was supposed to take weeks, and people were talking about, let's have a referendum and let's put it up to the voters and all of that, they put this thing through in one day. One day, they got this done. The Republicans are very serious with their agenda. And the closeted phrase here is states' rights. They say it is no accident that we are the 24th state to go the way of right to work. It's no accident. The reason is, of course, the Democrats have fallen down on the job. When nearly half of the states of the United States that has long been seen as a bastion of vigorous unionism has allowed about half of the states to basically curtail workers' rights like this, it says something about the state of affairs with unionism. The unions fell down on the job, plain and simple. And that is regrettable because a number of things are dovetailing all at the same time. We have an extremely high unemployment rate. Now, I'm not talking about the 8% that is normally put out there. I'm talking about in some communities, like the African American and Latino communities, where the unemployment rate is way, way above that, perhaps two or three times that. And we're not talking about the unemployment rate for teenagers. It's in some communities, it is like 80 or 90%. Staggering. So people in this condition are eager for any kind of work. They don't care about the terms. And that is natural. You have that working along with a general disaffection with government, period. People are tired of government. They're disgusted with it. They don't want really too much to do with it anymore. They're opting out of this process. They see that the government is not listening to them. If the government were listening to them, they wouldn't have to be scrapping like this for jobs. So in a climate where the unions are lax, the unions have forgotten the art and science of organizing and getting their act together and reaching out to communities and working in those communities to allow workers to feel empowered and educated about employment and the terms of employment and the benefits of unionism. The unions have fallen down on the job, plain and simple. They could say what they want, but that's the fact. And you have the, on the political end, you have the conservative Tea Party / Republican backlash occurring, mad as hell that they lost the first 4 years to Barack Obama, and here again, they're about to repeat the cycle. They're mad as hell. They've lost momentum. And anything that they can seize upon to advance their cause, because they are gearing up for a fierce fight to reclaim what they see as lost ground. In the end, of course, the workers lose, but this is politics. And politics doesn't take that into consideration. Politics is about prevailing and being the dominant one. And that is why a process that was conjectured, the Democrats were thinking, well, we'll at least have some more time to fight this, to fight it and to rile up the community behind us and to, take this on as a political fight. And they were expecting that this would go on for quite a few weeks and that they could force a referendum on this issue. Well, hello, it happened in one day. One day, and it is now law. And they couldn't do a thing about it because they lost control of both houses. So it would be interesting to see whether this registers within the union movement. I know it's great in a time like this to export the anger and point outwardly. But this is a very important moment for the union movements in this country to really seriously do some introspection. They've lost ground, they've lost momentum, in some cases they've lost interest. And in some cases, it has to be owned up. The unions opted out, and they did so at the wrong time and for the wrong reasons. Union leadership had become weak, and in fact, union leadership had become partners with some of the anti-worker measures that were considered and enacted all across the country. You can't tell me that you have a vibrant labor union movement and a vibrant political, democratic political movement when 24 states, as of today, and Michigan is now the second they call it the Rust Belt state after Ohio, to adopt the right to work legislation. So if this is not a cry for immediate examination, internal examination, I don't know what will serve as a wake-up call to the labor union movement to really get serious, because for many of the Republicans, this is not just an incredible victory in the case of Michigan. It is consolation that the overarching philosophy is at work. What is that overarching philosophy that I'm referring to? It is states' rights. The program is to dislodge this operating system that we've had for a long time, where we consider ourselves the United States of America. There is this movement that says, well, we will unite in our interests only. But unless it serves our interests, we are going to operate on states' rights. And so the dislodging has occurred. People, the governors of these various states are affirming their rights, essentially to form miniature nations, operating on their own terms. This, by the way, has been accelerated also by the election of Barack Obama. Part of it is a racist reaction to having a black president. And you can tell from the last two cycles of campaigning for the election, for the presidential election, that an incredible fear has come over America, white America. And they're getting ready to say, look, in the event that we lose control at the national level again, we at least could comfort ourselves in knowing that we can retain our sovereignty on a statewide basis. And we will begin to argue about our rights within the context of states' rights and within the context of federalism. The federal government having very limited power over what we do and what we, how we run our affairs on a state-by-state basis. So that in the event that we have something happening at the national level that we deem to be a tragedy, and Barack Obama's very presence in the White House in many, many parts of the United States is deemed a tragedy, because what's next? You know, you get a woman president, and they couldn't abide that, or you may have a Latino president. Who the heck wants that? Who will respect that in this racist country? So in the event that something should be happening on the national level, we at least have a good fallback position, and we can affirm our rights within our traditional areas of influence in the various states in which we tend to prevail. And that you will see in the South, and you will see it in the West, the Midwest especially. So this situation has a lot to do with the passage of this legislation today. I'm looking to see how the union movement responds, and it's not enough simply to be out there in the streets, and people do need to be out there in the streets, but it is saying something very clearly. It's saying something to union leadership. And the fact that it went to sleep and has been asleep for a long time, and just like the Republicans are now reassembling themselves and reasserting their power and reorganizing for long-term fight and long-term controls, the union movement has to do exactly the same thing. It has fallen down on the job. There is no question about that. I know somebody would call and say, you're wrong, but that's okay. That's just my opinion. So that is happening. What's also happening is this. I don't know if you, I didn't see it really covered much, but the Justice Department has gotten a settlement out of HSBC Holdings, the mega bank, and they're touting it as a record settlement. HSBC has to pay, cough up, $1.9 billion. That's with a B, billion dollars. Now, for what reason, you would ask? Well, for money laundering. HSBC has been proven to be a launderer of drug money. And not just in the United States, but also in the United Kingdom, where it is based. But it has deliberately skirted banking rules and regulations here in the United States and in other countries as well. And they have international laws on banking. So HSBC cannot say they didn't know. How is this possible that they continue as a company? HSBC pleading guilty to money laundering, drug money from Mexico. And it's not the first time that, you know, this didn't happen once or twice. The Senate had conducted investigations into HSBC, and they found that they were doing some really unpalatable things. In the Cayman Islands, for example, they had 50,000 client accounts, and they were stashing away $2.1 billion there. How does this happen? And nobody knows. Well, okay, the Justice Department decided, all right, we're going to shut this down. And It meant we're going to bring HSBC to account for this. And HSBC finally admitted, yes, well, we didn't know, but some people within our organization, apparently, some rogue employees we have who refused to adhere to our very, very high standards of banking may have done some really bad things, and therefore we are culpable. So to the extent that we are culpable, we pay $1.9 billion back to you. But they're still operating. So this is the latest in the scandals of these banks and what they have been doing and what they've been getting away with. I've been talking about this before. How is it that the banks continue to do this kind of stuff? I'm talking about straight out criminal activity. And there is no expression of, well, you will forfeit your charter from the White House. We're not getting those responses either in the Senate or the House. Nobody's calling for any bank to be shut down. The Federal Reserve isn't saying, well, HSBC ought to lose its charter here, its right to conduct business in the United States or any of the U.S. territories. Nobody is going that far. They're limiting the damage strictly to, well, pay a fine, and then we'll forget all about it. And you will do A, B, C, and D, and they get a slap on the wrist, and you naughty, 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 naughty bank, don't do this anymore. And the bank says, okay, you got me, but I'll pay you the fine, and then it will all, my boo-boo will be gone. And that's the way we've been doing business. I'm talking about renegade banks, rogue banks. These are criminal enterprises, and they're operating as such. And we get nothing from this administration or any previous administration where these things have been going on. to say, all right, well, therefore, you lose your charter. You lose your papers. You lose your right to do business. If you are operating in this fashion, you're not operating according to the law. You're not operating according to banking procedures. You're not operating according to basic standard business requirements. You ought to lose your charter. Well, you tell me what you think. At 1-888-874-4888, we'll take this break, come back to your thoughts right after this.
And Mac Heath spins like a sailor. Did our boy do something rash? Suki Tawdry, Jenny Diver, Lottie Lanyard, Sweet Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, dear. Now that Mackie back in town.
Oh, yeah, Louis Armstrong with Mac the Knife. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about rogue banks and about the limiting of workers' rights in the state of Michigan. What are your thoughts? At 1-888-874-4888. I wanted to add to the issue of HSBC that this follows just in October. The Justice Department's lawsuit against the Bank of America, claiming that the Bank of America had sold back to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the housing arm of the federal government that subsidizes or helps to bring the cost down of housing. It sold the federal government hundreds of millions of dollars of bad mortgages. And so they have a $1 billion lawsuit facing them. So, and this was not the first time. This was not the first time that regulators had to move against Wells Fargo and Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America and now HSBC, but no instance of any suggestion that the federal government would also move to nullify their charters. Rudy from Montreal, thank you so much. You're on the air.
Thank you, Ms. Utrice.
It's Utrice. Just Utrice.
Ms. Utrice. okay. The first thing is for the banks. I think if they had to close down all the banks that dealt with drug activity, there would be not very many banks left.
Well, you know, it would still give you, it will give the community banks a shot.
Sure.
You know, the smaller banks a shot. This is big time gangsterism going on here within the banking industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I blame them for causing all this massive depression worldwide because of the activities they involved themselves in, having to do with all these leveraged activity. Which is destroying so many companies and businesses throughout the United States and Europe. But the other thing I wanted to talk about is the unions. I think what's happening also, on top of what you were saying, and it's quite correct what you were saying, that there is this loss of the confidence both in the government and in the unions' activities. But there is another thing that comes into the point of view. On the company side, they are massively underfunded in pensions, and a great majority of the people who are reaching retirement age, their pensions are unfunded. And what is happening is that these corporations, rather than dealing with the problem, they've decided to go elsewhere. And because their profits are not taxed in the United States that they make outside of the United States, they have a massive advantage to leave all these unfunded liabilities for the people to end up paying, or the government, which are the, is a people, which are the people, and they get away scot-free. And then they have to beg the corporations to come back to the United States if they'll only pay 5 or 6% of the massive amount of money they've accumulated worldwide without paying taxes on.
Well, that's a very good point. And here, too, you see, because, I mean, there's a world community of nations, and they have all these different conventions all the time, and, you know, big-time meetings in which they agree to police themselves and to adhere to some method of operating. But they're moving all over the place. They're crashing in one country and starting in another, and they're transporting their loot to this other country, and they start spreading them out. So do you get a sense? You obviously have been studying this. You see the pattern happening, and the banks are truly global, is what you said, and that is true. So what should happen?
Well, the problem is that this drug activity for the banks was an unofficial government activity. So you can't very well destroy a bank because they're underhandedly carrying out government activity. And my understanding is that governments were utilizing drugs to be able to purchase armaments for certain groups who were going to overthrow particular governments. And it's probably far more extensive than I know. But the thing
is, because just recently there was some discussion about the Pope's bank, the Bank of the Vatican,
exactly.
And it's laundering of drug money.
Yes. Well, I guess if governments wanted to solve the problem, they could attack the problem, because, I mean, if you steal something out of a store, they're going to get you immediately hogtied and thrown you into a car and brought you and carried out all kinds of activities against you. But it seems, you know, the thing is, once the wall fell in Berlin and the communist threat was no longer there. Before that, they had to treat people reasonably. They had to treat unions reasonably. They had to treat people reasonably. But as soon as the wall fell, then that threat, which would kept them in line, at least as a decent working people, getting a fair share fairly, then that was okay. But then as soon as the wall fell, there was no checks and balances to the government's powers. And so they, as all people do who have power, generally most of them are going to use it in a way that helps themselves, and irregardless of what it causes elsewhere.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's a very, very considered opinion, Rudy. Thanks so much for making the call today.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, what do you think about Rudy's contribution today? 1-888-874-4888. Just again, to go back to the theme of the banking, we had Citigroup having to pay a fine just in 2007 of $285 million. J.P. Morgan Chase, $153.6 million. Goldman Sachs, $550 million. The banks they're happy to pay the fine and just keep on going on with their business. You know, this is not cramp their style. They are making literally trillions of dollars. And we discussed not too long ago that only five banks own 56% of the U.S. economy. So this is no big deal to them. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs. Doing very, very, very well. So to pay $550 million when you're talking in the trillions in assets, it's no big deal. But we see no movement. The Federal Reserve isn't saying anything. I haven't heard from the White House, have you, about the concern about the banking industry and its apparent unwillingness or inability or downright refusal to police itself or to abide by the law. We have just general gangsterism. Now, if you were to add up, maybe that's the ploy. The ploy is to just get the banks to pay up, so that's how the Barack Obama would bridge the budget gap, by just raking in the dollars from offending banks, and therefore that will help bridge the budget. We need to hear something from the administration and the various arms of this administration that are charged with policing this industry, that it is concerned about this, that these banks are actually engaging in criminal activity. But again, according to Rudy, maybe it is because the government itself is a party in this affair of generating funds and putting their funds to use in not so pristine ways. The unions should be asked some tough questions at this point. They should really have to come to terms with this. They should be calling a major convention right about now, asking themselves, how the heck did we lose 24 states? How did that happen? And what does that say about the state of affairs within the labor union movement? Now, for a lot of people, they'll say, well, why are you criticizing the unions? Because they need some criticism. Precisely at a time that the union movement should be extremely clear in its mandate, and it should have a portfolio of victories, the labor union movement itself has fallen down on the job. And that's sad. That's very sad. Now, in a right-to-work state, for example, this is not just affecting people in the workplace where you would expect a union presence, but this affects the entire state. Let's take a state like Florida. In the state of Florida, an employer could fire you for whatever reason. Maybe he just thinks you're not tall enough, or he doesn't like your makeup, or doesn't want you around. After 2 months, he is bored, he wants somebody else, or he just cannot carry you anymore. The employer has the right to just fire you, just like that. No advance warning, none of that is needed. And by the way, this has crept even into government jobs. This is going on more and more in government positions where you see this kind of attitude going on. Sid from Maryland, you're on the air. Hello? Is Sid there?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Sid.
Yes, I just wanted to add that in addition to the banks that you already mentioned, and I'm not sure if you mentioned it already, but Wachovia, the now defunct Wachovia, I think they were bought by Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
2 years ago, they were caught laundering $378 billion in drug money. And I think they were made to pay a fine of $600 million and had to promise not to do it again.
Isn't that great? Isn't that nice?
Yeah. And if I remember right, during the 80s, Ronald Reagan appointed a special prosecutor, I think his name was William Black, during the SNL scandals. And I think they sent 1,500 bankers to jail, 1,500 people to jail at that time, I believe. And I don't understand why that same thing hasn't been done in this case with all these banks?
I think it's a question that we need to ask, and it needs to be pointed out over and over again that, you know, this two-sided business of holding the people to one standard, and, you know, banks can do just whatever they please to do. And they are engaging in illegal activity. They admit it. They don't fight it. You know, like HSBC has not said, now we're going to hire our, you know, customary 25 lawyers and fight this thing. They just said, okay, yeah, we see where this happened. And they came up with the excuse, well, it's, you know, some of our employees, but that makes us liable by extension. And therefore, although we don't engage in this as a bank, for the sake of our brand, we will concede it and pay whatever fine is assessed and just move on, putting this behind us. That's atrocious.
Yeah.
Do you think that if we, you and I, got caught in that similar situation, do you think we'd be given the opportunity to say, look, all right, okay, you caught me, let me pay a fine, and let's put this behind us and let's move on? You think that would happen?
It's not happening now. It never has, as far as I know.
No, it wouldn't. But thank you, Sid, for that piece of information. That was good to put in the pot, because that tells you that this is an ongoing problem, and the banks now have become used to the idea of, you know, this is a business loss for them. It's just a loss. They could even write this off, I imagine, under certain tax codes, and it could just go on with their business. But it's something that needs to be paid attention to, especially in these hard times. Thanks, Sid. Thank you for calling in. 1-888-874-4888. This is how life goes. This is how life goes. And this is why when you hear, you know, at particular times, when especially when elections are in play and people start talking all this nonsense, and you start digging things up, and you go, my gosh, well, what happened when this happened? What did you say? Like Barack Obama went to Michigan to make the point. Yes, we need this to be a union town, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But last year, when this was going on in Wisconsin, you know, we didn't hear very much. We didn't hear those sentiments from the White House. So it's politically expedient to say it now. It wasn't politically expedient to say it then. So what becomes a big deal now was no big deal then. This is politics. And this is why people are so turned off, because the hypocrisy is just too much. And when you see this going up against the anticipation of what will happen when the fiscal cliff issues are resolved, the people will bear the brunt. The people will bear the brunt of this, because they're going to raise taxes and they're going to make cuts. No matter what they say right now, that's what they do. It certainly is not the only way to resolve the situation. For example, have we seen an innovative approach yet? No, there's no innovative approach. There won't be an innovative approach. It's still going to be the president, and it's still going to be the Democrats and the Republicans sitting down playing politics with the money. It doesn't matter after a while that these folks take into account that there ought to be a different way. I mean, the United States has produced more than its fair share of Nobel Prize winners in economics. We got brains here. We got serious brain power. When was the last time you saw a battery of Pulitzer Prize-winning economic advisors who may have a bunch of different theories, but are there to advise and inform the eventual decision that the president and the two houses of Congress would make? But we have people who are not. Imagine this. They are in charge of trillions of dollars. Barack Obama is not an economist. Boehner is not an economist. And they won't take advice from economists who have the knowledge and expertise. So that's what I'm talking about. They prefer to keep the fight where it is because ultimately it is about power and the exercise of power. What happened in Michigan is about power. And for the long term, it is not just a fight about workers' rights in the here and now. It is not about a piece of legislation. It is also about reorganizing the power equation between the federal government and the state, the reaffirmation of state rights. That is clearly what is happening. And there is that racist element, which I just talked about, that in the event that something should happen that they don't agree with at the national level, the states have within their power to basically form their own little nation and run it according to their will. That was the whole point of federalism, that the government's job is to be limited. Just like this situation, in fact, the governor said it very clearly. He says, look, what's going on in Michigan is our affair. Barack Obama has nothing to do with this. So he could go to Michigan and he can talk Paul and preach Saul, but in the end, it's the state that makes the decision. States' rights. So what looks like a union fight is a larger political fight. And in this larger political fight, the one piece of the puzzle that could have done a lot to change the course of things would have been the unions. But the unions didn't come through. Just today, we see that the Hostess company, the maker of Twinkies and Ding Dongs and other such abominations to the diet, used up the pension money. Well, they're going to fold. They, in fact, have decided they're folding. Right. And in making the exit, do you think they saved the pension funds for the workers? No. They used up every penny. Before they even shut the doors down, everybody got their bonuses and whatnot, and a lot of the bonuses were paid for with pension money that should have been the workers. Now, the question is, these workers are unionized. And this did not come, this did not creep up on them. Hostess had been talking about shutting down for quite some time. It went through the court process for bankruptcy and so forth. A sharp union would have made it imperative to get an injunction that said, in the event that you close, the pension funds are not to be touched. A simple thing like that. The pension funds, and get the court to order it to not use the pension funds in any way. Somebody was not looking. So the pension funds have gone to reward the management. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I want to thank you so much, Sid and Rudy, for your calls and for bringing yet another dimension to our discussion today. We'll get back with each other tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel, prn.fm. Thanks.